Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we are tackling something that is just. It's incredibly widespread and can be truly devastating for people. Peripheral neuropathy, or PN.
It's a huge topic. And our listener, the learner, has sent us this massive stack of sources, clinical trials, research papers, you name it all, zeroing in on one thing, finding real solutions for peripheral nerve pain.
And this isn't some niche condition, is it?
Not at all. I mean, this is a major public health problem. We're talking about something that affects between 7 and 8% of the entire global population.
Wow.
And as anyone who lives with it will tell you, this is so much more than a mild discomfort. It stems from actual damage or, dysfunction of the peripheral nerves, and that leads to these incredibly challenging pain profiles.
Tell us a bit more about that pain profile, because I think understanding what's going wrong with the nerve is the first step to figuring out how to fix it.
It's so complex because the nervous system is essentially short-circuiting. It's malfunctioning and amplifying signals that shouldn't be there. So patients experience what's called pain hypersensitivity, and that shows up in two main ways. First, you have mechanical allodynia.
And that's.
That's pain from something that shouldn't be painful at all. Like the simple touch of a bed sheet or clothing on your skin becomes excruciating.
Unbelievable.
And then the second one is hyperalgesia. This is an exaggerated, almost severe response to something that is already painful. So a minor bump can cause just disproportionate agonizing discomfort.
So it's like an electrical short circuit and a chemical fire all at once.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Exactly. So our mission in this deep dive is to be your guides through all this material. We've got sources that span, well, thousands of years and thousands of miles.
We really do, from ancient Tibetan herbal remedies and common vitamins you might have in your kitchen, all the way up to the most sophisticated modern pharmaceuticals.
Things like gabapentinoids and even cutting-edge research into these tiny molecular signaling pathways.
So we're going to categorize all of it, analyze these findings, and really try to answer that core question. Which herbs and natural compounds show the strongest evidence for treating this kind of pain? And importantly, how do they stack up against the conventional treatments, the ones that are established, but, well, sometimes risky?
Before we jump in, you mentioned something important about the evidence. Where is a lot of this data coming from?
That context is vital. A lot of the foundational data we'll be talking about, especially on the how and why these things work, it comes from what we call preclinical models.
So, animal studies, rats and mice.
Exactly. We see a lot of references to models like chronic constriction injury or CCI. That's where a nerve is physically pinched to mimic a traumatic injury.
Okay.
And there's spinal nerve ligation, SNL, and also models of diabetic neuropathy, which is often induced with a compound called streptozotocin, or STZ.
And that mirrors the metabolic damage you see in diabetes.
It does. And while we always have to be cautious with animal data, these models are absolutely essential for isolating the specific mechanisms. They let us see how a compound actually works at the cellular level.
That context is crucial. Okay, let's start this deep dive where the evidence for natural solutions is really compelling. The learner is clearly interested in this, and it's amazing how often the success of these natural treatments just boils down to a few core strategies.
What's fascinating here is the elegance of these natural compounds. They often go right for the root cause of the nerve dysfunction,
Which is.
oxidative stress, and chronic inflammation. I mean, we can really group the most effective natural agents into two big categories. You've got your foundational compounds, vitamins, antioxidants, that provide this broad defense.
And the second category.
Those are the heavy-hitting botanical extracts, the ones that use these highly specific multi-target mechanisms to really get in there and fix things.
Okay, let's start with that foundational defense, the antioxidants and vitamins. Right away, alpha-lipoic acid, or ALA, just jumps off the
It
page.
really does.
This compound, it's also called thioctic acid. It isn't just another supplement, is it? It feels like a consistent player with some of the strongest clinical backing we found, especially for diabetes.
Absolutely. ALA is, well, it's arguably the most studied natural compound for diabetic peripheral neuropathy, DPN. The sources are crystal clear on this.
So it's effective.
It's efficient, and it's safe in DPN treatment. And the clinical benefit is twofold. First, it improves the subjective clinical signs, which means the patient actually feels better.
Which is huge.
But critically, it also improves objective metrics like nerve conduction velocity or NCV.
Wait, hold on. Improving NCV, that means it isn't just masking the pain, it's actually changing the speed at which the nerve sends signals. That's getting at structural repair, isn't it?
Precisely. If the NCV improves, it's a strong suggestion that the compound is tackling the underlying pathology, you know, the cell damage, the demyelination, not just acting like a painkiller.
So it's not an analgesic, it's a restorative.
It seems to be. And the research didn't shy away from high doses, which is really important for understanding what works in a clinical setting. One pivotal study we saw looked at high-dose oral ALA, specifically 800 milligrams a day.
Okay.
And this was in patients with non-insulin-dependent diabetes who had a pretty serious complication called cardiac autonomic neuropathy, or CAN.
Wait, so this isn't just about tingling in your feet and hands. This data is suggesting a benefit for the heart.
It does. Cardiac autonomic neuropathy is a very, very serious complication of diabetes. It impacts the nerves that regulate your whole cardiovascular system. And the study found beneficial changes in heart rate variability, or HRV parameters.
So what does that tell us?
It suggests that ALA's protective antioxidant effects go way beyond the peripheral limbs. It can potentially help with complications in the autonomic nervous system, too.
Yeah.
It really highlights its role as a systemic neuroprotectant.
And it seems like ALA is a team player, too. It works well with other treatments.
Very much so. We saw some really compelling data on what's called synergistic use. When ALA at a dose of 300 milligrams a day was combined with a standard pharmaceutical and aldose reductase inhibitor called apalristat.
Right.
The patients showed significant positive effects. Better motor and sensory nerve conduction velocity, and improved symptom scores.
So that points to a path forward for integrated treatments, mixing natural compounds with targeted drugs.
Exactly. And its role goes beyond metabolic damage, too. It also showed it could prevent and treat oxaliplatin-induced neuropathy in mice.
That's a chemotherapy drug.
Yes. So it underscores its broad value against chemically induced nerve damage as well.
That really establishes ALA as a foundational defense.
Okay, moving on, we see the classic vitamins E and C popping up a lot, which just reinforces that whole idea of fighting oxidative stress.
They are the quintessential defensive line against that kind of damage. You can think of oxidative stress as this chemical war happening inside your nerve cells, where these reactive oxygen species are causing all this structural damage. And vitamins E and C are the peacekeepers.
They're the scavengers. They go in and mop up those free radicals. And the sources note that this action inhibits nociception, the sending of pain signals, and it dials down those oxidative stress markers, especially in the spinal cord of neuropathic rats.
And vitamin E has a specific, powerful application in chemotherapy that we really need to highlight here. This takes it out of the general health bucket and puts it into critical preventative treatment.
Absolutely. This is so important. Vitamin E showed a statistically significant and frankly powerful role in decreasing the incidence of peripheral neuropathy in patients who were getting cisplatin chemotherapy.
How powerful.
The risk ratio was incredibly low at 0.28. That means the protection was substantial. It also decreased something called sural amplitude reduction, which is an electrical sign of nerve function loss.
So for a cancer patient who's facing a treatment that could save their life but also permanently damage their nerves,
for them, vitamin E becomes a targeted, evidence-based preventative strategy against a really harsh long-term side effect.
Another powerful compound in this antioxidant group is N-acetylcysteine, or NAC.
Well, NAC is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Its effects aren't just in pain modulation, but crucially, in measurable functional recovery. In those CCI rat models, the ones with the crushed nerve, NAC treatment improved the partial recovery of the sciatic function index, or SFI. And the SFI is a direct quantitative measure of how well the nerve is actually regenerating, how much function is coming back.
What's the mechanism there? What's driving that functional boost?
The improvement was tied to the downregulation of something called PP38 expression. You can think of P38 MAP kinase as a key signaling protein, like a switch, really, that mediates both neuropathic pain and nerve regeneration.
So by turning down that switch,
by downregulating PP38, NAC is simultaneously quieting the pain response and supporting the nervous system's ability to rebuild. And just like ALA and vitamin E, NAC also showed effectiveness against that same chemo drug, oxaliplatin.
It's amazing. You have three powerful antioxidants, ALA, NAC, and vitamin E, all showing promise against chemotherapy-induced neuropathy.
It really suggests that protecting against oxidative stress is a highly effective, conserved strategy for preventing this kind of nerve injury.
Let's quickly touch on two others, zinc and melatonin. They seem to address different but still vital aspects of this.
Right. Zinc was looked at for DPN because of its antioxidant role. In diabetic rats, it reduced markers of lipid peroxidation, basically damage to the cell walls, while upregulating a protective protein called metallothionein. Again, it hammers home that oxidative damage is central to DPN.
And melatonin.
Melatonin is a bit different. It's not really a primary nerve regenerator, but it addresses a critical quality of life issue.
Sleep, which is almost always a problem with chronic pain.
Always. We found data showing that when you use it alongside gabapentin, a very common pain drug, a small 3 milligram oral dose of melatonin in these patients led to significantly improved sleep quality.
And this was measured properly.
Yes. Assessed by the Epworth Sleepiness Scale and the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. Since chronic pain and severe insomnia go hand in hand, having a tool that demonstrably improves sleep is a vital part of comprehensive care.
That gives us a really strong baseline of foundational nutrients. Now, let's pivot to what you called the heavy-hitting botanicals, the concentrated extracts that seem to offer more specific, targeted healing.
Yes, these are the compounds that are less like a general shield and more like a targeted firefighting crew or a construction team.
So they're more sophisticated.
They often hit multiple targets at once, which gives them this huge therapeutic potential. We can start with quercetin. It's a common flavonoid. You find it in lots of fruits and vegetables, and it's known for its profound anti-inflammatory power.
And quercetin seems to be focused on damage control, right? Minimizing the fallout from an acute injury.
Precisely. It showed significant efficacy in ameliorating peripheral nerve ischemia reperfusion injury. That's the damage that happens when blood flow suddenly returns to a tissue that's been starved of oxygen.
And how does it do that? What's the key?
The method of action is critical here. It modulates the NF-kappa B pathway. You can think of NF-kappa B as the cell's on switch for inflammation.
The master regulator.
Exactly. When a cell gets injured, NF-kappa B is what signals the full inflammatory response. By modulating this pathway, quercetin acts like a comprehensive firefighter, minimizing the initial blaze after an injury. We also saw it used in severe trauma models, like brachial plexus avulsion, where it fought both oxidative damage and the inflammatory infiltration that drives chronic pain.
From quercetin, let's move to curcumin. From turmeric, everyone knows it's anti-inflammatory, but does that specifically translate to nerve pain?
Oh, absolutely. Curcumin is another one of these phenolic compounds with a potent dual action. In that chronic constriction injury model, it showed clear anti-nociceptive, so pain-reducing effects.
And the mechanism.
We know it involves a crucial reduction of key inflammatory markers, specifically tumor necrosis factor alpha, or TNF-alpha, and interleukin-6, or IL-6. These cytokines are like the loud distress signals that are just screaming inflammation to the whole nervous system.
But it goes deeper than just silencing those alarms, doesn't it?
Yes, because it also interacts with the nerve support system. Curcumin modulates glial fibrillary acidic protein, GFAP, and nerve growth factor, NGF, in the spinal cord.
Okay, break that down for us.
So GFAP is linked to the activation of support cells called glia. If these glia stay agitated, they can perpetuate chronic pain. NGF, on the other hand, is essential for nerve health and survival.
So curcumin is calming down the agitated support cells while also boosting the factors that help the nerve survive.
Exactly. It's calming the pain response and supporting a healthier microenvironment for the nerve to recover. A dual action.
Now we get into some more specialized but incredibly potent traditional medicines, starting with a discovery from the Tibetan plateau.
This is where modern science meets ancient tradition, and it's yielding some amazing insights into brand new pathways. There's a Tibetan herb, Lamiifolius rotata. Our sources describe it as an orally available painkiller. And critically, it reduces pain hypersensitivity by activating spinal glucagon-like peptide 1 receptors. GLP-1 receptors.
GLP-1. I associate that with metabolism, you know, appetite, blood sugar. What is it doing in the spine to relieve pain?
That's the cutting-edge discovery, which shows that these pathways we thought were purely metabolic were actually deeply integrated with pain signaling.
So it's a completely new way to tackle pain.
It's a unique, non-opioid, non-jabergic mechanism for reducing nerve pain. And the research even identified the active components, which allows for standardization and further study. It just proves that traditional medicine can point us toward pathways that modern science is just beginning to explore.
And the rich tradition of Chinese herbalism offers some similarly specialized tools, especially for mitigating the side effects of modern medicine.
Look at purin. It's derived from puriri lobate radix. This compound showed distinct protective effects against chemotherapy-induced neuropathic pain, specifically from vincristine.
And its mechanism is another one of those multi-target examples, right?
A beautiful example. It inhibits the NF-kappa B inflammatory pathway, just like quercetin. But at the same time, it activates the TGF-beta-MAD pathway.
Okay, give us the layman's description. What does activating that second pathway mean for a damaged nerve?
The TGF-beta's MAD pathway is crucial for cellular regulation and tissue healing. So purarin doesn't just put out the inflammatory fire. It also gives the nerve cells instructions on how to regulate and heal themselves properly. It's promoting repair, not just blocking a symptom.
We also saw some entirely novel signaling pathways being targeted by these complex traditional formulas.
Right. Take Maxion powder, a traditional Chinese herbal drug. Research suggests its mechanism involves inhibiting the IPIC1 piezo2 signaling pathway.
Which is?
It's exciting because it's a completely new target for neuralgia treatment.
Yeah.
It's outside of the usual suspects like ion channels or general inflammation.
And what about that other one, the Wang Li and Wendin decoction?
That one showed protective effects against the cognitive deficits and neuronal damage you can see in diabetic encephalopathy, a brain complication of diabetes. It works by inhibiting inflammatory cytokines and repairing insulin signaling in the hippocampus. It just highlights the integrative nature of these multi-compound remedies.
Shifting back to more common extracts for a moment, green tea offered some surprisingly strong functional data. We're moving beyond antioxidant protection here and into measurable physical recovery.
Yes, green tea extract, or more specifically its active component EGCG, provided some of the most compelling evidence we saw for functional recovery after an injury.
How compelling.
In sciatic nerve crush models, the EGCG-treated animals showed significantly better motor recovery. We were talking a 50% greater improvement in function. They even had an earlier hopping response compared to the control.
50%.
50% greater motor recovery. And they also showed reduced mechanical allodynia and hyperalgesia.
That is a remarkable number in an injury model. I mean, how does that level of functional regeneration compare to what we usually see with pharmaceuticals, which mostly just focus on suppressing pain?
And that is the exact question you should be asking. Most pharmaceuticals are aiming for pain reduction. EGCG appears to be promoting physical regeneration and accelerating the return of motor function. That makes a very powerful argument for its use, suggesting it supports the actual structural rebuilding, not just masking symptoms.
And in that same regeneration category, we have ginsenoside re.
Yes, ginsenoside re from ginseng berries and roots. It shows a clear protective and regenerative effect on peripheral nerves after a sciatic nerve crush injury. Its molecular action is attributed to the PI3-KKT pathway.
Ah, the PI3-KKT pathway. That's one of those crucial regulatory pathways. Can you explain its function simply for the learner?
Absolutely. If a nerve has an internal construction crew that's needed for rebuilding and survival, the PI3-KKT pathway is the master foreman. It's a major hub for cell survival, growth, and preventing cell death. So by acting through PI3-KKT, ginsenoside re is effectively activating the underlying biological machinery that damaged nerves need to rebuild themselves and survive the injury.
So if we look across this whole natural spectrum, from ALA's foundational defense to the multi-target mechanisms of quercetin, puerin, and ginsenoside re, the unifying conclusion seems pretty clear.
It really is.
The best herbal approaches work because they're highly effective at fighting oxidative stress and inflammation, while at the same time activating pathways for nerve cell survival and physical regeneration.
Exactly. They offer multimodal therapeutic action. They're fighting the fire, cleaning up the mess, and starting the rebuild all at once.
Now, let's pivot and look at the traditional Western pharmaceutical standards. And here's where it gets really interesting. Because while we have established efficacy for these drugs, the sources reveal some new and frankly concerning safety data, especially for the drugs that are prescribed the most often.
We have to start with the class of drugs known as gabapentinoids. So gabapentin and pregabalin. These are, without a doubt, considered first-line treatments for a whole host of neuropathic pain syndromes, like DPN and postherpetic neuralgia.
They're powerful, but their mechanism is a bit unique, right? We know they work, but they don't really fit the mold of a traditional painkiller.
That's right. Gabapentin's specific anti-allodynic action, that reduction of pain from things that shouldn't be painful, is still being fully deciphered at the molecular level. But preclinical models confirm it works, and huge multicenter trials have established its clinical efficacy. The class is also evolving. We see newer analogs like gabapentin and acarbil and mirogabalin. The effectiveness is not in question.
However, the critical issue we have to talk about is the long-term safety of these incredibly widely used drugs. The sources delivered a finding that I think demands our immediate attention.
This is a vital caveat, a crucial takeaway for you. A key finding we analyzed compared the long-term benefits and harms of gabapentin and pregabalin, and the data indicates that chronic long-term use of both of these first-line drugs in patients with diabetic neuropathy was associated with a statistically increased risk for serious cardiovascular events.
Let's just pause on that. Serious cardiovascular events, we need to be very specific about what that long-term risk actually is.
The list is, well, it's comprehensive and it's alarming. We are talking about an increased risk for heart failure.
Okay.
Myocardial infarction, so a heart attack.
Yeah.
Peripheral vascular disease, stroke, deep venous thrombosis, DVT, and pulmonary embolism.
Wow. And this isn't just with years of use.
No. What's more, the risk was seen not just in chronic users. Even short-term pregabalin use was associated with an increased risk for DVT and peripheral vascular disease. For a patient population like diabetics who are already at a high risk for cardiovascular problems, layering this additional risk from a pain medication is, well, it's a tremendous concern.
That creates a huge clinical paradox. If these drugs carry such serious cardiovascular risks, why are they still so often preferred? Especially for patients who are already high risk.
It's a complex calculation. It's about comparative safety profiles and drug interactions. Despite these new findings, gabapentinoids are often seen as the lesser of two evils compared to older drug classes, like tricyclic antidepressants or TCAs.
How so?
Our sources note that gabapentinoids have a more favorable profile when it comes to drug interactions. They have minimal liver interference. This makes them a preferred choice for patients with other issues, like heart disorders, glaucoma, or urine retention, where TCAs might be flat-out contraindicated or carry even higher immediate risks.
So it highlights the difficult reality of treating chronic pain.
It does. We're often choosing between imperfect options, and that balance of risk is constantly shifting as new data like this emerges.
That context is so important. Now let's shift to opioids, which are, to put it mildly, highly controversial for chronic neuropathic pain.
The controversy isn't just about addiction risk, though that's huge. It's rooted in the pathology itself. Neuropathic pain, this abnormal signal processing, is fundamentally different from acute pain, like from a broken bone.
Right.
As a result, neuropathic pain is generally less responsive to pure opioid analgesia. Your standard morphine or oxycodone, they get prescribed a lot, but their efficacy for true nerve pain is highly debatable.
And some of the sources suggest an outcome that's far worse, that chronic use could actually make the underlying problem worse.
That is the most problematic finding. It's a phenomenon called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, or OIH.
So the opioid itself causes more pain sensitivity.
Exactly. Chronic morphine treatment, even a short 5-day course, has been shown in preclinical models to exacerbate nociceptive hypersensitivity after a nerve injury. In essence, the attempt to manage pain with these drugs can, over time, actually amplify the underlying pain signaling issue. It's a profound complication.
Are there any opioid alternatives that seem to work better with neuropathic pain pathways?
Yes. Drugs with mixed mechanisms show a bit more promise. Tapentadol has a dual mode of action, and it showed significantly lower neuropathic pain scores in breast cancer patients with painful bone metastases.
So a combined approach might be better.
It seems so. The sources also highlighted a peptide called crotalfine, which inhibited hyperalgesia by acting on delta and kappa opioid receptors, completely different subsets that might be more relevant to nerve injury pain.
Moving away from direct painkillers, let's talk about the aldose reductase inhibitors, or ARIs. These seem to be targeting a key metabolic pathway in diabetic nerve damage, aiming for a cure, not just symptom relief.
ARIs are crucial because they try to address the cause of DPN. They inhibit something called the polyol pathway. In diabetic conditions, excess glucose gets shunted down this pathway, creating toxic byproducts that damage the nerve cells.
So if you can block that pathway, you can theoretically halt the progression of the disease.
That's the theory. And compounds in this class, Ibelrestat, Fudarostat, and others, were shown to improve sensory and motor nerve conduction velocity in diabetic rats. Tolrestat, specifically, induced beneficial changes in cardiovascular reflex tests.
But there's always a trade-off.
Always. Tolrestat was associated with a safety concern, high transaminases, which is an indicator of potential liver impact, a reminder that even targeted therapies carry systemic risks.
Finally, we saw a couple of antidepressants mentioned.
Right. Antidepressants are used because they modulate descending pain pathways from the brain down the spinal cord. They influence how the central nervous system processes pain signals.
So they're changing the brain's interpretation of the pain.
In a way, yes. Duloxetine, an SSRI, is noted as effective for chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. Another SSRI, fluvoxamine, showed anti-allodynic effects in a diabetic model. Their value is in modulating the brain's own ability to regulate and filter pain.
We've covered the chemical toolkit, both natural and synthetic. Now, let's broaden the scope a bit to include physical interventions and some of the cutting-edge cellular mechanisms being targeted. This really shows us where the future of non-drug treatment lies.
It does. And this section reveals the kind of ingenuity you need when systemic drugs either fail or just carry too much risk. Sometimes the solution has to be regional or physical or hyperspecific at the molecular level.
Let's start with a surprisingly simple but effective physical one, cryotherapy.
The results for cryotherapy, simply applying cold, were extremely compelling, specifically for preventing chemotherapy-induced neuropathy from drugs like paclitaxel.
How does it work?
In breast cancer patients, the very low-tech act of applying cooled gloves and socks during the chemo infusion significantly lowered the incidence of severe sensory and motor peripheral neuropathy.
That sounds like a remarkably low-cost, high-impact intervention. What's the theory behind why that works?
The theory is vasoconstriction. The cooling physically restricts the blood vessels in the hands and feet. This limits how much of the cytotoxic drug can actually reach the peripheral nerves during that critical infusion window. It acts as a temporary non-drug shield.
The significance of that low-cost, high-efficacy protection is just huge for patient care.
It can't be overstated.
Okay, from physical cooling to regional chemical intervention, nerve blocks are still a key tool.
Absolutely. Epidural injections, which combine steroids with local anesthetics like lidocaine, are established standards for severe radicular pain and posturpedic neuralgia. But the sources highlighted the advancements in how they're delivered.
Better technology.
Exactly. Using ultrasound-guided methods is now crucial because it lets clinicians see and avoid vessels during these delicate procedures, like injections into the neck. Procedural safety is evolving to match the precision needed.
And for the most severe autoimmune forms of neuropathy, like CIDP, the whole strategy has to shift to managing the immune system itself.
Right. In autoimmune neuropathies, the body is attacking its own nerves, so the treatment has to involve powerful immunosuppressants and biologics, rituximab, cyclophosphamide, IVI.
The goal is just to quiet the immune system.
Quiet the systemic inflammatory cascade.
Right.
But we also saw evidence of drugs serving a dual role. The immunosuppressant, FK506, for example, also resulted in significant improvement of reinnervation after nerve repair surgery in rats. It confirms that immune modulation and nerve repair are deeply linked.
Let's pull the camera back and focus on the fundamental molecular targets that seem to unite all of these diverse approaches. What are the core pathophysiological mechanisms we should be tracking?
The sources really point to three major interconnected areas. First, inflammation driven by microglial activation.
Okay, what are microglia?
They're the immune cells of the brain and spinal cord. When a nerve gets damaged, microglia become activated, and they become the engine that fuels chronic neuroinflammation and pain signaling.
So silencing that microglial alarm system is a massive therapeutic goal.
A huge goal. And the research points to some really sophisticated ways to do it, like using nanoscale delivery systems, siRNA, to silence a specific receptor on the microglia, effectively cutting the power to the alarm system that perpetuates pain.
And the second major target?
The ongoing damage from oxidative stress, which, as we saw earlier, is what the natural compounds handle so well.
It's the thread that connects everything.
It really is. ALA, the vitamins, curcumin, EGCG, they all directly mitigate oxidative stress. And on a signaling level, we can look back at that P38-MAP kinase pathway. We noted that NAC modulates this protein, which confirms that P38 is a central mediator linking inflammation, pain, and the nerve's ability to regenerate.
And this knowledge also allows for targeting highly specific pathways that drive nerve-related diseases, like the tumors in NF1.
It's a perfect application of this research. In neurofibromatosis type 1, the RSERC signaling pathway goes haywire. And that's what drives the growth of these peripheral nerve tumors. So the clinical solution is to test MEK inhibitors, which specifically target and disrupt that hyperactive growth pathway to shrink the tumors.
And finally, the third target, the receptors and ion channels themselves, the actual physical gates that control the electrical signals.
You have to manipulate the nerve gates. The TRPV1 channel is a major, highly accessible target. It's famously modulated by topical capsaicin, the stuff in chili peppers.
Which is a paradox, right? It causes burning at first.
It does. It activates the receptor, causing that transient pain, but that's followed by a prolonged period of relief in the area because it desensitizes the receptor. Additionally, we saw that blocking other receptor types, purinoceptors and adrenoceptors, also reduces mechanical hypersensitivity. By shutting down the specific receptors that are over-transmitting these abnormal pain signals, you can get profound relief.
So what does this all mean for you, for the learner? We have navigated a huge amount of data here, from ancient wisdom to nanoscale delivery systems. We have a complex toolkit.
It means that successful treatment has to be multifactorial. It's not one drug or one herb. It's the strategic use of compounds that address the specific underlying dysfunction, whether that's metabolic, inflammatory, or the nerve's inability to physically regenerate.
And if we narrow our focus back to our original question, which herbs treat peripheral neuropathy best, based purely on the quality and specificity of these mechanisms, what rises to the top?
When you focus strictly on herbs and natural compounds with the strongest, most specific evidence, a clear group of leaders emerges.
Who are they?
First, alpha-lipoic acid. It stands alone because of its proven clinical efficacy, especially in DPN. It shows measurable, objective improvement in nerve conduction velocity.
Okay, number one.
Second, the dynamic duo of anti-inflammatories, quercetin and curcumin. Quercetin targets that NF-kappa-B master switch, and curcumin quiets crucial distress signals like TNF-alpha and IL-6, all while minimizing the systemic risks you see with synthetic drugs.
Got it. And third?
Third would be the functional regenerators, EGCG from green tea extract and ginsenoside rate. Both provide impressive evidence for promoting actual motor and sensory nerve rebuilding through pathways like PI3K-AKT.
And finally,
you have the novel mechanism pioneers like that Tibetan herb Lamiiflomis rotata, which opens up entirely new avenues for pain management by activating those spinal GLP-1 receptors.
So the ultimate takeaway is clear. Effective treatment relies on hitting those crucial goals: reducing inflammation, mitigating oxidative stress, and promoting physical nerve regeneration. And the natural approach often excels because it tends to be multi-target by its very nature.
The complexity of PN demands that kind of multimodal approach. It ensures we're not just masking pain, but actually encouraging the nerve to heal.
Now, for the final provocative thought for you, the learner, to consider. Given the serious systemic cardiovascular risks we identified with the long-term use of common first-line drugs like gabapentin and pregabalin risks that are especially concerning for a high-risk population like diabetics, and then considering the extremely promising multi-target anti-inflammatory and antioxidant mechanisms we see in compounds like quercetin and puerperin, how might future standard treatment protocols evolve to integrate these potent, naturally derived compounds early on? Could using these safer multimodal agents not only maintain efficacy, but also strategically lower a patient's long-term cardiovascular burden, bridging that gap between established pharmaceuticals and effective herbal intervention? The conversation between herbs and drugs in pain management is very clearly just getting started.